You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Every few years, Aotearoa's beech trees produce a great quantity of mast or fruit that feeds many of our native birds, but also our pests. This coming year, conservation experts are gearing up to suppress what they expect will be an explosion of predator species in a mega mast. And once the beech fruit is gone, they'll turn their eyes onto our protected species. I began our look into this issue by talking to Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, James Russell.
So, to start us off, the mega beech mast that's coming up, could you give our listeners a bit of an overview of what it is, really?
Mast seeding is a really interesting reproductive strategy that a number of plant species, some of which we have in New Zealand, use. In New Zealand, we have beech forest and tussock grassland, and what they choose as a reproductive strategy is rather than just predictably going every year where the predators can key in on it and know that it's going to come, they kind of wait what seems like randomly, and then just once every couple of years, they just drop all their seed at once in huge numbers. And so the things that would usually eat that seed and stop it turning into plants is unable to respond to that in time. So it's a really good evolutionary strategy, and scientists have recently discovered that what generates that is it's actually the temperature differential. So it's not actually random. The plants sort of have an internal body clock that says, oh, there's been a big change in temperature from last year, so I'll use that as my motivating cue to drop all my seed next year. And so the challenge with this is when all of this seed drops, it creates this trophic fountain which explodes up the food chain, and then all the animals respond to it, some of them being the animals we want to get lots of food, but some of them being ones that we don't want to feed up, such as the introduced predators.
So we get a huge explosion in population from both native species and these predators. In the long run, what sort of impacts does this have for our conservation efforts?
So before humans arrived in New Zealand, this was a really good strategy which New Zealand birds and other animals evolved towards. So they knew that if they just bided their time and waited until these mast seeding events happened, they could have bumper years. So species, particularly parrots and parakeets, such as kakapo, kaka and kakariki, they would wait. And when all that seed comes, they would explode in numbers and have a really great reproductive year that would see them through for many years to come. The challenge is when introduced predators arrived, they also benefited from this, and they realized that they'd stay at really low numbers, but when these big seeding events happened, there'd be all this food. So rats and then stoats would explode in numbers in response to this. So for a while, that's okay, as the rats and the stoats are just competing with the other native birds for these seeds. But then what happens is the seed stops because the mast seeding is completed for the year, and then all of those introduced predators turn around and go, oh, well, we're really hungry still, and there's lots of us. How about all you birds that have just had lots of babies? We're going to come eat all of you now. And so that's that huge problem where we see that negative repercussion, where the mast seeding event, which would usually have been good news for our bird species and still is in the kakapo program, for example, turns into bad news a few months later when the swarm of predators turns on them.
So is this quite a significant part of the conservation headspace? If you're thinking about protecting birds or protecting taonga species, that this is a core moment?
Over the last 20 years, we've really realised it's pretty critical in terms of preserving our bird species that we have an awareness of this. There's generally two types of forest across New Zealand. We get what's called podocarp and or broadleaf forest, and that's what dominates in the North Island. And it's when you go down to the South Island that you see a lot more of this beech forest, which is where the mast seeding happens. The podocarp broadleaf forest tends to follow a more normal, regular pattern of just seeding and fruiting once a year, although they too can have good and bad years to create a bit of unpredictability. But it's really down in the South Island that this beech forest has these major mast seeding events. And in this case, it's not even just the whole of the South Island will do it this year. It really comes down to microhabitat and that temperature differential. So DOC now have the models to forecast where these mast seeding events are going to be strongest. And for this one coming up this summer, they know that mast seeding is going to be happening basically from the top of the western, northwestern South Island all the way to the bottom in Fiordland. Mast seeding is a really interesting experiment in ecology. We learn a lot about natural systems, so it's been really great that we've been able to do what's called fundamental science and just understand what's the ecophysiology that motivates these plants to seed. It used to seem random to us, but now we understand it's this temperature differential. And then it's a great example of how someone working on fundamental science was able to translate that and work with applied scientists who were saying, this is really a problem that we have these explosions of pests following these mast seeding events. How can we use that fundamental science to help help us better predict our monitoring and when we have to do this implementation. So it's really been quite good that we've been able to now translate that science over just 10 or 20 years into really applied management to stop these extinction events. And in 1999, in the top of the South Island, they lost the last population of mohua or yellowhead because we just didn't know that we didn't know how to predict these events or how to respond to them appropriately.
Right. And with our growing ability to predict them, are we seeing any connection to things like climate change, or is it more of a relative year-to-year thing?
The role of climate change in this is really interesting because it's a temperature differential effect, climate change shouldn't make it more or less common. Although the hot years will get hotter, the cold years will also get hotter. So it's still about that difference between the hottest hot year and the hottest cold year. So we shouldn't see a greater change in mass eating events from it. But what we are trying to do is, as the new frontier in pest management, is rather than just having these pests pulse through every few years and eventually decline our populations through to extinction, is move from what's called pest suppression, which has been the predominant model in the New Zealand mainland, pest suppression where you just crush the numbers down to very low numbers and stop them exploding. We want to move towards something that we do on the offshore islands of New Zealand, which is called eradication. And there's this in-between ground called elimination, which is where you might not be able to find every last individual and eradicate them from the North or South Island today. But what you can do is eliminate them so that they're no longer able to find others to breed with. So they're at such low numbers that even when these mass seeding events come through, the animals aren't able to breed up because they just can't find each other. So this is really an interim step that we're applying at the moment as we work towards a predator-free New Zealand where we might actually be able to eradicate these predators from New Zealand. And there's parts of New Zealand already, particularly down in South Westland, so Franz Josef and Okarito townships and the surrounding forest and farmland, where these rats have now and stoats have now been eliminated and they just can't find each other. There's still the odd one that comes through down the road or crosses over a stream or comes over the mountaintops, but it can't find anyone to breed with. So that's a really exciting frontier, which just gives us another tool to conserve our native species. Doc do great work translating that fundamental science into applied management outcomes. I think the real critical thing we're looking at is return on investment or bang for buck. So how much does it cost per year to suppress pests per hectare and having to commit to that in perpetuity versus how much can we pay to eliminate these rats from the landscape. So for example, if we can eliminate rats from the landscape and then keep them out for $100 per hectare per year, that's pretty much a bargain basement price and something we could actually afford across the whole of the country.
With 1080, I know that there are some people out there who feel very strongly about it. How do you approach that issue?
Ultimately, we're doing this conservation, I like to think, first and foremost for the birds, but we're also doing it for people. It's people making decisions for the birds and enacting those on behalf of the birds. So the use of toxins that people have created is fundamentally a human-centered decision. So I really like to work with communities, and that's what we've seen through Franz Josef and Okarito. There's communities, there are people there that were resistant to poison use, but people have sat down with them, had a lot of cups of tea that ironically have 1080 in them at trace levels, and said, look, if we move to elimination, we just get to use 1080 once and then we don't have to come back and use it every 3 years or every 5 years with mass seeding events. If you just let us use it once and we pursue this elimination strategy, then in the long run we can stop using toxin, which is better for the environment and better for animal welfare. So that's really what I'd like to move towards. But at the end of the day, it's just about having a conversation and making sure people are on side and that their concerns are addressed and they don't feel sidelined in the decision making about pest management and conservation.
Right, so lots of consultation with the community. On the 1080 and the tea, what's going on there?
1080 is a naturally occurring substance. So what happened was it exists in tea and eucalypt. And I think I did a back of the envelope conversation once that if somebody managed to drink 200 cups of tea in a day, they might start to feel some impact of 1080. But if you've drunk 200 cups of tea, you're probably going to have other bodily function issues coming up first. But then scientists realized that it did have toxic effects at very high dosages. So that's what scientists did back in the day. They extracted the toxin and learned how to synthesize it in the laboratory so they could manufacture it. And then obviously everything is a toxin at high enough doses. We've all heard the joke about how if you have too much of that horrible chemical H2O, then you might keel over. But it's all about really just the dose response.
I then spoke with the coordinator of the Department of Conservation's, or DOCS, Predator Control Program, Peter Morton.
I'd love to get DOCS' perspective on everything. We heard it was a big challenge. In conservation terms, a pretty core and significant moment. What does the megamast mean for DOC?
It means that there's an exceptional level of risk for some of our most threatened wildlife because of the spike in predators that are coming on the back of the mast. So we're particularly worried about some of New Zealand's most threatened wildlife. Just a couple of examples are kea, the alpine parrot, mohua or yellowhead. There's rock wren that live up in the alpine zone, and a very rare parakeet, kakariki karaka, or orange-fronted parakeets. All of these are only found in the South Island, and they're all going to be at higher risk from rats and then stoats as predators. So what we're doing is cranking up our predator control in response. We'll do a lot more work than usual in two phases. The first is happening now, where we're trying to push predator numbers down as low as possible before the beach seed is produced in the coming autumn. So between now and roughly February next year, we're really pushing hard on predators at a whole lot of sites across the South Island. We're going to have to stop then and wait until the beach seed is gone. We found it's ineffective to try and control predators while the food glut. Once that beach seed's germinated or been eaten, we'll be back for the second phase with a whole lot of work at the beginning of 2027.
And is this mostly through ground trapping? Is this through aerial coverage? How do you suppress the populations?
We use everything we've got. Look, the scale of this is enormous. Ground control is useful, but we'll just be overwhelmed with the hundreds of thousands of hectares of conservation land that's at risk. So the biggest and best tool we've got is Aerial 1080, which has done a really good job in previous masts of stopping the impact from rats and stoats on these threatened wildlife populations.
And when you drop 1080, this is in a more physical form? This isn't sort of spraying, right? This is how does that look?
Ah, sure. 1080 is a biodegradable toxin, and a very small amount is mixed in with a small pellet, like a little cereal blob about the size of the end of your thumb. The pellet's dyed green, which deters birds, and it's got a cinnamon additive in it because that flavour also deters birds, but actually attracts other things like possums. We have very tightly controlled application of the bait from helicopters using GPS locating equipment to place a small number of baits in exactly the right places. We are applying about 4 to 6 baits in an area the size of a tennis court. So there's not a lot of baits hitting the ground in any given area, but we are covering a lot of ground. So we'll try and protect roughly 600,000 hectares of New Zealand's public forests using Aerial 1080 coming summer.
And these areas are mostly based in the South Island. I'm sure there's quite a few of them, but could you give us some just general examples?
Yeah, sure thing. So essentially, it's our most well-known national park. So Kahurangi up in the top of the South Island, New Zealand's biggest national park. Also, Mount Aspiring National Park, Arthur's Pass, that's the only sort of naturally occurring population of orange-fronted parakeets is still found there, and also Fiordland National Park as well.
Professor James Russell talked about these mastings, especially one as big as this one, have the potential to be deeply threatening to our local species, to the potential of extinction. Do you buy that?
Oh, totally. Yeah, he's absolutely right. One of the reasons we've learned about mast and are responding so forcefully is because of the experience that occurred in Mount Stokes, for example, in the Marlborough Sound, where the local population of mohua or yellowhead were wiped out because of the intense predation pressure that occurs when these masts happen. So we've learned the hard way that if you don't stop predators during a mast, you definitely can actually see populations of threatened species wiped out completely.
And with all these resources that DOC is committing to this, how much of a drain on DOC's resources is controlling this masting going to have?
Well, it's what we're here for. So this is a real important piece of work from a conservation point of view. We've done this before. We've learned through successive masts that have occurred over the years how to do this. It's a big job. Pest control contractors, they're going to be flat out over the next few months. we can do this. We're resourced to make a decent effort.
And as we wrap up, if our listeners have any way that they want to help out with masting or just conservation in general, what sort of ways might they be able to?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and is a very valuable contribution being made by the members of the community. The best move is to connect with one of your local predator control groups. There are groups all over the country. I'm just going to mention a couple that are relevant to the beach mask. So, for example, the Southern Lakes Sanctuary Trust does a lot of really good work in Makarora and Matukituki and, Mount Aspiring National Park. And Friends of Flora, who for decades have been helping look after a chunk of Kaharangi National Park. If people want to help plug into a local community group, a good way to find them is through the Predator Free 2050 website, which coordinates community effort towards predator control.
Finally, is there anything you want to share with our listeners before we end things?
It's a fantastic natural phenomenon that occurs in our beach forest. So beach masks aren't a bad thing, but they do have a sting in their tail with the predators that also spike whenever a mast occurs. But we've learned through really good science and monitoring and research to predict them, what's happening, how to deal with them, and how to at least take the edge off the biggest impact in terms of the risk to our threatened wildlife.
That was Peter Morton, the coordinator of the Department of Conservation's Predator Control Program, and before that, James Russell, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, discussing the upcoming mass fruiting of beech trees, which is expected to cause an explosion in predator populations, and the conservation efforts aimed at controlling it.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.